Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
As soon as journalist Liz Carlisle joined United States Senator John Tester's team as legislative correspondent for agriculture and natural resources, she immediately started getting calls from his fellow sustainable farmers who were clearly up to some really cool things out in desolate central Montana. Early on, Liz realized that she had to figure out how some guy in Conrad, Montana, had turned a crash course with bankruptcy into a million-dollar business. And that's when she joined the Lentil Underground. The Lentil Underground is a group of renegade farmers who share in their dedication to a common task, patiently building the subterranean ecology of an entirely new type of business, cropping system, and future. Liz Carlisle writes about it in her new book, Lentil Underground. The book is published by Gotham, and we welcome Liz Carlisle to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on the program.
Very nice to have you here. So how do you define the Lentil Underground?
Well, the Lentil Underground, as you were saying, is this group of people in central Montana who, you know, at the core of the movement are interested in moving from a paradigm of rugged individualism to a greater appreciation of interdependence, both in their farming systems and in their community.
So what does interdependence mean? You write about this in the book, but for the purposes of our conversation, how interdependent?
Well, the great thing about lentils is that they pull nitrogen from the atmosphere and work with bacteria to convert it to a plant-available form. So it's nitrogen fertilizer that they're providing both for themselves and for other plants in the rotation. So that's the interdependence at the farm scale, is this idea of plants working together. And then at the human scale, in communities, what this group of people had to do to form an alternative farming system was share equipment, share knowledge, work together.
So how did we find out about the power of the lentil?
Well, you know, there's actually a lot of different legumes that can do this. I got interested in it while I was in the tester office because I know that synthetic fertilizer is a major environmental issue. It's a big culprit in terms of the climate change problems associated with the industrial food system. And, of course, it's also expensive. It's connected to oil prices going up and down. So farmers were telling me, you know, we can produce fertilizer biologically. And this is a really important thing for us to think about in terms of the sustainability of our food system going forward.
When it comes to what is happening in Montana, how are we able to replicate that throughout the rest of the country?
Well, you know, I think that the story of this movement is a story of people starting with their own environment and what works in their environment, and then innovating a food system that will work for that environment and adapting ideas from other areas. So I think in other parts of the country and other parts of the world, people can do the same thing and think about what's possible just from the plants and the biological resources and the human resources that are there, rather than needing to prop up some kind of an industrial system with chemicals.
You tell this story through the lens of one third-generation Montana farmer. Tell us about him and ultimately what he is doing, as I mentioned in the introduction, to go from bankruptcy to this huge business.
So the main character of Lentil Underground is David Oyen. And as a 27-year-old guy, he decided he was going to come back to the family farm in Conrad, Montana, and try to make a go of it. But this was just as industrial farming was really starting to come to this part of Montana. And so he realized that his parents' farm, which had been big enough for his parents, was not going to be big enough to survive in this sort of industrial system. He just wouldn't be able to produce enough to make enough money on small margins. And he didn't want to use all those chemicals or go into debt to buy big machinery anyway. So he realized he was going to have to do something very different and started thinking about what kind of organic farming system would work in this part of Montana that's really dry, that has short seasons, and that isn't next to a major city. So you're not going to be able to do farmers markets and that sort of thing.
So he was able to bring these farmers together, and it began with lentils to show what could be done, especially when they all work together.
Right. Yeah. And so they had to create their own markets, their own facility, their own production capacity, processing capacity, and then develop relationships with mostly independent natural food stores all over the country that wanted to partner with them in a sort of domestic fair trade fashion, where people who are interested in healthy food and healthy food systems are supporting farmers at a distance who are stewarding their ecosystems.
So when it comes to the individuals who are a part of this movement, what do they have in common? What do they have in common with David that made this work?
You know, I think everybody in this movement has a commitment to this agrarian land ethic. They really want to take care of their land. They want to nourish their families and their communities. And they don't want to be stuck in a commodity food system. They really believe that it's possible to do something else, and they would like for their farms to continue to be productive and successful for many generations. And the industrial food system just seems like a dead end.
It certainly seems that, as you talk about in the book, that this is and will always be a really big fight, a David and Goliath fight with big farming, even though it is very successful.
Yes, I think that's true, certainly at the present moment, that corporations really have a stranglehold on the food system in many ways, but there also have always been these alternatives that have existed, and people have been deeply connected to their own food through farming and cooking and all these ways that we interact with food for the entire history of human society. So I have hope in that.
And let's talk about that hope. Let's talk about the optimism. What needs to happen so that this can be replicated beyond the borders of Montana?
Policy change needs to happen. We need to think about why we have these structures in place that give an advantage to corporate farming. The structure of our subsidy system, the structure of how crop insurance works. There's a number of policies. Some of them are farm bill policies, but some of them are outside of the farm bill that need to change at the federal level. International trade agreements really need to change. There's policy at state and local levels as well. And so that the advantage isn't already sort of tipped towards the corporate actors.
When you think about the actual crops, what are the numbers? What are they producing? You mentioned in the book they're selling to Whole Foods, they're selling to other independent natural food sources. But what are the numbers?
The immediate group of people that I'm writing about who are growing for Timeless Seeds, you're looking at 20 to 30 family farmers who, and their places vary in size, but let's say an average of about 5,000 acres. And they're able to sustain that farm. So that's about what you're looking at in terms of the size of this community and this movement. So relatively small comparative to the whole of American agriculture. But if we had pockets like that of these regional food systems focused on regionally appropriate rotational crops all over the country, I think that kind of distributed model of food systems change could really make a big impact.
What is fascinating about the book and about the story that you tell is that there's a really wide range here of individuals that from all kinds of political backgrounds, from certainly from environmental activists to Christian homesteaders to libertarians. It is a very wide range of people who are involved in this project.
Yes. And I think the lesson of that for me is that you don't have to be the same as somebody else to collaborate with them on something really impactful. And that's what's been encouraging to me about a number of political movements, contemporary political movements. And the 99%, the Occupy movement, is absolutely one of them. And this one was too.
So this is the Grain Belt, and you write about in the book of how ultimately that the food system can be fixed within this Grain Belt and through the world of family farms. So, I mean, this goes back to an earlier question of how you bring it beyond the confines of Montana. But what kind of drive does this movement have, an interest in other farmers and family farmers who would want to go this route?
I think a lot of family farmers are interested in sustainable agriculture. And I think there's just not an awareness in the consumer sustainable agriculture movement quite often that this is happening. But family farmers typically are interested in the same things as organic consumers in a metropolitan area. They want to take care of their land. They want to pass it on to the next generation. They want to be good stewards. They want to produce healthy food. They would like to produce food that their own family can eat. So I do see other movements like this in other parts of the country, and I think it's just a question of making sure we're connected and collaborating and using that energy towards federal policy change.
You talk about this in the book, but one of the pluses here, and there are many, but one of the pluses is how agriculture can be more resilient to climate change, and that by doing this, because the summers are hotter and drier, and the growing season is hotter and drier, that actually these crops can be more sustainable.
Yes. Yeah, and one of the basic ways in which diversified organic farming is more resilient to climate change is that you've just got more options. You've got more crops, and so if one doesn't do well, others might. But the other part of this has to do with taking care of soil health, because that's important for storing water in the soil. And in real dry areas, and especially ones where farmers are farming without irrigation, it's really important to have good soil quality so that you are able to store the moisture that you get, and then that allows you to be resilient during times of drought. And it's these diversified organic systems that create those kinds of healthy soils with that soil water storing capacity.
So what do you hope the average consumer and certainly farmers get out of the book?
Well, I'm excited for people to discover lentils and start, experimenting in their kitchen. And, thinking about what if we thought about, the ecological diet, and if we were thinking about eating within our water resources, we're talking about water and drought, how might we change what kinds of foods we eat at what time of year? And, maybe a reason to try something new and different.
The name of the book is Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America. It is published by Gotham Books. Liz Carlisle, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. Very nice to have you with us.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, Lentil Underground by Liz Carlisle. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.